is Life. I am Jason Snell, hosting this episode of Football is Life on The Incomparable, talking about Ted Lasso, Season 2, Episode 7, Headspace. Last week's episode, I told you at the end that I wouldn't be back and some new group of people would be on. The new group is here, but I didn't leave, apparently. Let me introduce the people that I'm talking to. I promise I'm not going to be on next week's. James Thompson is here. Hello.
Yeah, I don't want to do this.
Casey Liss is here. Hi, Casey.
You know, this episode better be lit because we've got a reputation to keep up.
That is fair. And it's Kelly Gamont. Kelly joins us, and she's perfect. And I know that because I spend every second of every day with her. Hello.
This podcast will set you free, but first it will piss you off.
All right. So, Headspace, episode 7. We are into the back half of season 2 of Ted Lasso. So things, it feels to me, tell me what you think, like they are now really ratcheting up the various story arcs, and we're starting to, I don't know exactly where they're going, but I feel like I have a better sense of where the show is going than I did in the first half. It seems like they're starting to really get everything in place and push the storylines forward so that, you know, a destination is, if not in sight, you get the sense that we are definitely heading for a destination here.
Yeah, I think that's true. I struggled a lot with this episode. I did enjoy it, and I think I stand by what I've been saying this entire season, which is that I like each episode at least a little bit more than the one that preceded it. But I don't know. One of the things that struck me in this episode, and it was most obvious, and I'm jumping way ahead, I apologize, but okay. It was most obvious when Roy had his epiphany on the pitch. But I feel like in so many ways, what I loved about season 1 of Ted Lasso is that anytime you expected them to make a right-hand turn, they always made a left-hand turn. And like, for example, when they got relegated, like, of course they're not going to get relegated. It's a feel-good show. Of course they're going to make it by the hair on their chinny-chin-chin. But they didn't. They didn't make it. And those sorts of left-handed swerves, I always really enjoyed. Whereas I feel like this season, We've gotten a lot more of walking down the expected path. Now, I could make an argument that maybe that is the left-hand turn because they did everything the backwards way the first season. Yeah. Now they're, you know, we're back going the normal way this season. I don't know, but it struck me that a lot of this episode in like the struggles with Ted and Dr. Fieldstone, is that right? Ted and the doctor, like so Dr. Sharon, Dr. thank Sharon, you. Yeah. Yeah, so much of that also played to the, it was on the path, it walked the path I expected them to be on, which was surprising to me. I don't know, did you guys get that as well, or am I being bananas?
I mean, I think there's definitely been things where they haven't done the expected thing, like the Sam Rebecca
That's true, story that's line. Very true.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, they were setting that up to be Ted, and it wasn't, and...
That's a really good point.
There's been a couple of things where it's gone the expected way, but also I think we're analyzing the show a lot more than we did in season one because we know that they're tricksy like that. I mean, I think the thing with this episode and with the season in general, I think the storyline that I'm not enjoying, and I think I'm not supposed to enjoy it, is Nate, who seems like he's one bad tweet away from slaughtering some younglings at the Jedi Temple. And I just don't enjoy his turn. But I get that what they're doing. There's a good, I would recommend just at this point, there's a good interview with Nick Mohammed on Vulture where he talks about seeing Nate break down in real time, and he actually says more in that interview than I think he should have said, because it kind of gives you a timeline as to where things might go. Mm-hmm. But it's worth it for the backstory, but still I came away with this episode kind of like, where's my happy show that makes me feel good in a pandemic?
Yep.
Well, we did get some of that. Part of what I appreciated about, like, one of the things I liked about this episode actually was the last bit, because it felt a little too neat and tidy for Nate to be like, again, rude to somebody, and then you know, Beard evaporates from his office. Yeah. And then which again, just, you know, more points to Beard for that. But for Nate to just sort of be on the right track all of a sudden after that, you know, that one moment. And so I thought that was like, I sort of appreciated that. Because that's not necessarily a very human thing. Like, you have one conversation with somebody who's like, you should be cool. And then you're like, oh, okay, I guess I'll be cool now. I sort of appreciated that was a more human reaction than what we might normally get. But some of what I feel like we got in this episode, I kind of wanted, like, even if you take out the Christmas episode, I sort of feel like we're maybe an episode behind where we need to be in order for stuff to happen the way it needs to. So either we're going to end up like just jam packed with the rest of this season with stuff that happens, because it kind of seems like everything's going to have to spin out really fast to get to a good point where we can stop and then pick up again in the third season. So I still kind of feel like, I appreciate that there's good pacing and there's the right amount of stuff kind of in each episode, but I still sort of feel like we might need one more and to give everything sort of room to sort itself out, because I still haven't, like, we never really saw anything resolve with Jamie and the rest of the team, because remember, it wasn't just Roy he was not very popular with.
Right.
And like, I feel like some of that stuff is kind of like, I don't know if we're just supposed to not notice it. Like, Jamie put tape across his uniform and said he was building bridges, and that was it. Like, that's all it took for everyone on the team to not remember he'd been awful to them for ages before that. Like, so I kind of like, I'm not trying to nitpick, but that was the thing I was sort of hung up on, because I was like, it's going to be really interesting to see where Jamie goes with this if they let him back in, and what that does, particularly after the setup of Sam and Ted's relationship, what that ends up looking like. Didn't get any of that.
About Jamie, I do think it goes back on one level too. We're doing a lot of analysis of this show that maybe we didn't do when we watched it the first time, is, you know, they did a time jump with Jamie because they weren't interested in telling the story of individual reactions to Jamie over that. So we jumped ahead and see that Jamie's sort of uneasily there. But then, of course, what the show wants to do is sort of talk about the rehab of Jamie. But it's more from the perspective of him learning when to turn on his inner asshole and when to turn it back off. The fact that he still wants, in this episode, he goes into the kit room to ask if they can make his name bigger on the back of his jersey, which I think is
very on brand,
a very funny, yeah. Funny Jamie thing. But I think that they have a plan for Jamie of what they want to show, and some of that stuff is not what they want to show. And it's the, I mean, talking about Nate, and I think this goes back to exactly what Casey said at the start, which is the way I think the season is making the turn you don't expect is that season one was about people getting on track and happy ending, sort of emotionally at least. And season two is about how nothing ever ends and there's more work to be done and it's not that simple. And so like Nate's great victory in season one of him being appreciated and not being treated as kind of just a lackey leads to Nate's problems in season two, and Ted's story, and you can go through it, like all of these stories. In fact, in this episode, it's also, look how perfect Keely and Roy are. And you know, that doesn't mean there isn't going to be conflict. I think the challenge with a show like this is everybody kind of wants it to be their comfort show, but they need to tell like stories about people dealing with, you know, who they are emotionally. And so the zag in this season is literally that all of those nice zigs in season one are not as neat as we thought they were, and they have ramifications. Yeah. Like Ted's marriage, you know, Ted is still bearing the burden of that, Jamie coming back in this season, like we are still feeling the weight of last season there. Keely and Roy, happily ever after. Well, other than Higgins, all relationships are complicated. Other than Higgins's relationship, that's fine.
I guess part of it is because we spent so much time last season with Jamie and his arc and his toolboxery. Well, you said it, asshole. You said asshole earlier.
Yeah, I did.
His assholery. Like, it is rampant, it is willful, it is abundant. And
But what we so get this
I,
season
I think
is,
that's part
is
of
the
why
idea that
the resolution was the part I wanted to see, because we spent so much time with that before.
Yeah, but he's a work in progress, I guess, is what I would say, is that the show is showing him be a work in progress and having more people. Like, we got enough. I think there's enough shorthand. Well, we're talking about another episode that already happened, but I think there's enough shorthand when Jamie comes back to make it clear that the guys are not really happy because he was a jerk, and that, you know, I don't know how much more of that they needed to show. Obviously, they decided they were just going to skip over it. And so they did.
And I think with Jamie, they are showing, like, he's becoming gradually more self-aware, even if he's still got the old tendencies of, like, wanting his name bigger.
Yeah.
You know, he has that bit, you know, not to jump completely around the episode, but the bit at the end, you know, where he has some insight, which is genuine. And
I think they're more interested in his progress as a human being than they're interested in sort of
his redemption story.
And his acceptance into the team, right? I buy the idea that, like, in Ted Lasso's locker room, they're not going to allow, and honestly, Isaac is the captain, right? They're not going to allow Jamie to do what he did before. And so, you know, he's not going to do that.
It's a different place.
And they're going to have to gradually just sort of, like, he's going to have to earn his acceptance over time. And that's how it's going to have to be.
Well, I want to ask about Nate for a minute, just because I actually was glad to know James was on this episode, because I think it's a question for James, and it's about football coverage. And is football coverage normally this fawning over something like this? Like, Nate should get his own team because Nate had a clever,
a
clever idea once.
Honestly, the fact that he has one bad tweet that he finds seemed incredibly unrealistic.
Yeah, but that was Twitter issue. That
happened
that didn't
to
have anything to do
the
with
one
the
that
press.
Scrolled by at that moment, right? Like, that just happened to scroll by and hit him in the moment. I feel like the media thing about him is absolutely true. The fact that you would immediately have some paper somewhere say he should, you know, is he going to be a manager? Like, is he going to be hired as some club's manager? I say that is exactly how stupid and ridiculous sports
journalism
is. I think
that is exactly how the thing would start. Because you've got to build somebody up before you completely tear them down in the media. So, you know, they're not yet at that part of the arc. I think the Twitter thing, I was just feeling it was unrealistic because there would be, like, just pages of racist tweets.
No, it would be,
And, you know, it's like a person of color in a prominent position in a football team. Yeah, we're not.
I mean,
really
we
great
actually have proof of that happening. So, like,
So
I'm not surprised.
One thing that I just wanted to say before we go further into it is this episode was written by Phoebe Walsh, who plays Jane in the show, and I didn't realize she was one of the writers.
I think maybe she is new this year to the writing staff because they did change their writer some. But that's good to know. All right, this episode starts with "I Got You, Babe" in a very ironic way because. He's here, he's there, he's every fucking where. Roy Kent, Keeley can't get rid of him. He is everywhere in their relationship, and now that they're working together. And it's really funny, and I got to say, this totally rang true to me, this idea that, you know, even if you are in a wonderful relationship with somebody, to have them, like, inescapable everywhere would be something that would drive you up a tree. And that's what's happening to Keeley. I love that about it.
I did wonder if this episode was written during lockdown and whether, you know, that factored into the writing, because a lot of us are in that situation 24/7.
Exactly. And so we get throughout this episode with Keeley and Roy, you know, we get that he is happy to be in a good relationship, and he loves her and he wants to be with her, but it has all these issues. Like, he wants her to pay attention to him, but she's working and she has to set him down, although that leads to her saying, oh, but you're doing what I tell you, you've ruined this now because that is so hot. But, like, he keeps on doing this, and she's confiding in people, and that leads to the big break where he is upset, not because she wants her space, but and also he's reading the Da Vinci Code and talking about the Knights Templar. It's like, Roy, come on. But he's a footballer, at least he's reading. What gets him is embarrassment, because when he comes into these rooms and asks, "Are you talking about me?" Obviously, yes. He's got a thing about that, right? And the answer is yes. And this is what they're talking about. And he says it makes him feel like a fool, like he's a lovesick puppy or whatever he says. And then he feels awful about it. And that's what really bothers him, is that she didn't talk to him about it. She went to other people and talked about it. And now he's embarrassed because she's embarrassed him in front of the people he works with. And I think it's an interesting, very specific kind of story. And of course, it culminates in him making a playlist for her and then saying the words out loud that will make your own local voice assistant play that playlist, which didn't happen for some people. I will say it absolutely happened for me.
It happened for me too. It worked perfectly. But then I was sort of scrambling to get Siri to stop, and then it was like I missed a couple of seconds of the episode.
We went for about a minute where I didn't realize, because we have surround speakers behind our couch and the HomePods are behind our couch, and I didn't know that the music was coming from the HomePods and not the surround speaker while they were still in that scene. And then I had a moment where I said, "Hey lady, pause." And I was like, wow, it was from that playlist. It felt perfectly natural. It just would have been very weird because it would have gone on to the next scene and the music would have kept playing.
I appreciate that he made a nearly 5-hour playlist for her.
Looked it up, it's long. Yeah,
it is. A lot of Sade.
Half of it's Sade. Well, I think Roy knows that Keeley's go-to bath accompaniment is Sade, so he filled it up with that and then added a bunch of other stuff in. That's my headcanon for that.
Some Susie and the Banshees as well, which yes. I appreciate.
I appreciated Mos Def and Susie and the Banshees. Those were the ones that stood out to me, yeah.
So isn't this the sweetest way to have a bunch of scenes about a relationship problem? It's like their problem is that they like each other too much.
And actually, speaking of Roy and Keeley, I have to, this is my role apparently, but I have to say that the automotive casting for the two of them is just so perfect for me. So Keeley drives this little two-door Mazda, what I would call a Mazda Miata. I think it's an MX-5 over there. But it's a little two-door, ostensibly sports car, but a little convertible. It's itty bitty and it just kind of bounces around, and it's very mini-ish, very happy-go-lucky, and just kind of her. It's very much her. And Roy drives, what is it, like a G63 AMG? So this is like the Mercedes G-Wagon, the big, boxy, brash, like, get out of my way, I don't care what you think, mm-hmm. Mercedes. And it's just...
He drives a bank vault that's been fitted with tires.
Yeah.
Well put. Yes, that is a much better summary. I'm glad you're here
especially
to say so,
yes, perfect. England, right? Especially in London. Right? That's a ridiculously large car.
Yeah, yes. I mean, they're not that big in the grand scheme of things, but yes, I agree. For London, especially, it is very big. And it's just, the two of those cars are so perfect. And even just silly things like that, that they take the care and the time to get right, it just makes me so happy.
Yes. What was it? Somebody was, I think there was a Twitter thread that was like, like each of the cast members as dogs or something. And then one of them was the one for Keeley was like lots of hairstyles. And that was what I was thinking about her car too, because we saw it with the top up and with the top down. So yes, also lots of hairstyles just like her. So I appreciated that. You're right about the automotive casting. That was very, it's very good. So I also appreciate Roy embracing his inner Wookiee, because we heard about that more than once throughout the episode. I guess it's his outer Wookiee too, but yeah. But he does growl an awful lot, so like I would just sort of that, respect that
line
about, him,
about the just enormous amount of hair in the drain is pretty great. No, I mean
I feel seen. I'm not gonna lie.
So this is a
thing.
So this is
the
a thing sitcom, with that, and so there are jokes. And this is sort of a sitcom-y plot about this. But I think what Ted Lasso always wants to do is get to the heart of these characters. And the heart of this, to me, is that Roy... I mean, yes, Roy's embarrassed about her talking about it with her friends at work, although they are also her friends, her coworkers. You know, it's going to happen.
But they're his friends too.
It's in fact, though, a little bit of the flip side of it, which is with him and her both being at work, who does she have to confide in who is not also, like, right? Is it a betrayal? But it's like, but no, she also needs friends to talk to. So I think it's part of the same thing. But my larger point is, although it is a little bit sitcom-y in that this is a thing that happens in this episode and it's a plot point and like, and it gets kind of resolved at the end, what I like about it is that it is about Roy failing to recognize Keeley's needs and being apologetic at the end and realizing that just because he wants to spend every second with her, it's not healthy and he's going to do better. And like, that's the resolution that I really liked here is, and I feel like that's the emotional point of this story is it's, fundamentally, as great as it's going, Roy is not recognizing, and nor is she expressing the her needs, because he actually literally says,
well,
"Can I come
him.
With you for tea?" Right to him, "Can I come with you for tea when they get to the work in the morning?" And she says, "Yes," right? And she could say no, but she doesn't say no. So I like that part of that detail of it.
Was she heading to the secret smoking room?
Oh, good point. I don't know.
I was convinced once we discovered it that that's where she was
possibly.
Yeah, I thought that she was like, she needed some alone time in there to have a cigarette after having been intensely frustrated probably by the journey in.
She found him lurking next to the refrigerator moments before, remember?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I felt like that she looked a little deer in headlights when he asked where she was headed because it wasn't where she would normally be going. So I think, too, it was the secret smoking room.
And that I was wondering, like, I had that other thought of like, oh, I hope she's not going off to talk to Jamie about this. But it wasn't that.
No.
As far as we know.
But I also loved the moment while we're on it. I loved the moment in the secret smoking room when Rebecca came in, made herself comfortable. Keeley and I have decided that in here, smoking doesn't count. Which just makes you wonder how many other conversations that the two of them had in there.
Sure.
In that terrible, terrible room that we remember from season one.
And Higgins produces a pipe from somewhere.
So which I think he only has so that he can be one of the girls in that room, right?
I don't think he smokes it.
No, I think he's just holding it professorially? Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
It so probably blows there. Bubbles or something would be my guess.
Possible.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, that's
which,
a
by the way,
good scene. Yeah, go ahead, Casey.
And Higgins, his absolute adoration and love for his wife that's been prevalent throughout this season, it just makes me so happy inside because he's such a dork and he's so socially awkward in so many ways. But he just freaking owns the fact that he is obsessed with his wife and it makes me so happy and it's so adorable and so pure. What did he say? Like it's something about it. My relationship is the oxygen that lets me breathe or that gives me life or something like that. It's so good.
I didn't realize that they are married in real life.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Yeah, and they've been together the same length of time that Higgins and the
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Well, you know,
now I want to hear the story of how they met in real life.
Right.
It's probably exactly the story.
Long, healthy relationships, there is this conventional wisdom that they are death for TV, for drama. And I've never agreed with that. I never agreed with that. And I think this show is in a way showing you like Roy and Keeley, that's a good relationship. And the challenge is how to find an equilibrium. And you see with Higgins and that you can, and it's fine. And like, I love that there's this kind of exemplar relationship there, especially since Rebecca is lamenting relationships in that scene and saying that it's, you know, they're terrible. And it's like, well, no, that's not true. Not all relationships are terrible, but you might have to work at it. But Higgins is very happy. And she's like, yes. Well, he's the exception.
Well, but that's Higgins. Yeah,
I like having a show that says, no, here's somebody who's in a happy relationship and it's great and it's fine. Like, it's fine.
Yeah. Well, it makes me so happy.
I know I'm not hosting, but I feel like we've tiptoed around the not so great relationship in this episode. And it's Ted and the doctor.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Well, yeah. Yep. Okay. We'll go there next, Kelly. That's fine. the Ted. So
I thought it was the most interesting. That's part of what, like, it was fun to watch Ted or it was fun to watch Roy and Keeley try and work out what they were working out. And, you know, and the team dynamics and Nate's thing. But this part was the part that I thought was the most interesting piece of everything that we got this time around.
I think what's interesting about the stuff with Ted and Doc Sharon is that unlike something like Roy and Keeley and him being too clingy, which is probably essentially confined to this episode, Ted and the Doctor is a season-long progression, and we get a part of it this time because last time we saw him have his breakdown and go in her office, and this time we don't get much, right? We get him trying to do it, and it wasn't as easy as he just poured his guts out at the end of the last episode and now he's fine. It's like, no, he still is grappling with the idea of even talking to her. And so we get the scene where he does what he calls couch shenanigans. he talks about, he asks, I thought this was a really interesting point. He asks why there are tissues in the office. And she says, well, sometimes people cry. I think that's interesting. And I think that shows maybe some concern on Ted's part about, does he want to walk down this path? Sometimes they sneeze. He deflects it because that's what Ted does. She reassures him and he says, I don't want to do this. And then the next time he comes in, he, because he doesn't quit things, he's still not bought in, right? He's not bought into the idea that therapy is something that works. It is, he says, you ain't listening because you care about me. Or you're listening because you're being paid to do it. This is actually exactly a reflection of that line last season. Was it last season that was, or was it at the beginning of this season maybe, that it's like, oh, we could all just talk to our friends about our problems. Yeah, it was the beginning of this season.
It was this, yeah.
And then nobody talks to each other about their problems, right? The friends don't talk to each other about their problems. And that's, so this is another echo of that, which is like, maybe I should talk to people who care about me, but we know you can't talk to the people who care about you, so you need to talk about something else. Anyway, he gets worked up and he storms out, and because we are trying to get, he's trying to find a way where he can actually talk about this, and so that leads to the third time through, right, where it you know, would you coach for free, but do you? Sports people are macho dickheads, consider me dunked on, right? Like that whole thing, including the line, it triggers your flight or fight or flight response. You did both. Impressive, really.
yeah.
And so, you know, and the final line about the, you know, can't be a mentor without being a tormentor, that kind of thing. Like he needs to work through it.
I liked in that way, he says, I like that. And she goes, I knew you would.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
That was a pre-scripted line. I can appreciate that.
Yeah. The wordplay of it. But he's struggling with, right? Like he knows he needs help, but he is resisting because he doesn't, he's probably always considered this sort of just a ridiculous thing. Like he says, it's bullshit. Like, you don't know me. And so he is desperate for help on one level, but on another level, like, it's not that easy to open up. It's not that easy for him, who has deflected everything and focused on other people, to actually, just like last season we talked about this, to actually say, I need the help. He has to work at it. And that's one of the things I like. So Kelly, talking about Ted and Sharon in this episode, like, I like the fact that it's just not easy. Like, to get to word one, he spends an entire episode where he basically can't do it.
And that was why I liked it, I think, is because he says he never quits, but I feel like that's not the only reason he keeps going back. And that was part of what made it interesting, was he's in this place where he can't just walk away from it, but he really doesn't want to be doing it either. And that was, and watching the tension of that and him try to talk to the doctor about it was part of what I enjoyed. And I also liked that she was really upfront with him, and this might be the most we've heard her talk all at once in the entire season so far, but you know, she straight up told him, like, I was offended by what you said about me and my job, and that I don't care, I'm just paid and that's why I'm here, and I didn't appreciate that, you know, that you are in exactly the same position, but you don't think of yourself that way. And I really liked the dynamic between the two of them once they finally started having a conversation and it wasn't all couch shenanigans and throwing Kleenex around.
I think also because he clearly got burned in the divorce, because he said that, you know, they went to couples therapy And I think that's why he has such a low opinion of it, because it didn't work.
It didn't fix
that situation. Didn't fix his marriage.
They're not married anymore, and so obviously it was terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, and Ted made mention, I think it was early this season, maybe late last season, that that he felt like he was being attacked because it was her counselor or her shrink, basically. And then they went in for couples counseling. I'm almost sure he had this conversation with Beard at the pub, that, you know, his now ex-wife and her therapist, they bring Ted in, and he said, well, it's like, you know, I was set up for failure from the beginning. And I would be pretty grumpy about that still if I were him. Like, not only did the reconciling of the marriage fail, but he was set up, from his perspective anyway, he was set up for utter failure from the beginning. And so, yeah, I would be pretty perturbed about the whole thing. I don't know. It's funny, because I was talking to my wife, Erin, and she was saying that in a lot of ways, and I think she's right, there's been a lot of like retconning with a lot of the characters, like Roy being so like touchy-feely and needy with Keely. Like, I buy it, but it's a very different persona than season one Roy. Nate, the turn with Nate, which I agree with James. I don't know if we're going to belabor the point anymore, but I agree with James. Like, I find it almost physically painful to watch sometimes.
I'm going to do a footnote here, because I feel like a lot of modern TV discussion is people saying, I don't want dramatic things to happen, but like, you're meant to feel bad. I just saw our friend Glenn Fleischman post a thing about how he was angry at the end of the episode because of Nate. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. Like, that was not a mistake.
It's not a misstep.
That, like, is, works as intended.
That's what the show's trying to do.
They have decided, you know, what that arc is, and it is a major feature of this season. I think
we're all disappointed in Nate.
I think we're disappointed in Nate, the character, but it is also like, because the show was kind of like, especially first season, was this kind of one shining light in a particularly crappy time, that this time around, people are judging, I think, the season harsher than they did that season, because we're all more burnt out and jaded by this point. but, you know, I think I can agree that they've decided what they're doing, and they're doing it. And yes, you do need drama, but I think it's equally valid for people to say, I don't enjoy watching this, because whatever I've seen people say that, you know, it is bringing up actual memories of bullying in a way that they were not, I guess, ready for in this show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, if you expect this to be like, this is, and that's fine. I think if people have decided that what they want out of Ted Lasso is nothing but positive feelings, the producers of Ted Lasso feel like they need to, while keeping their ethos, they do need to actually explore the fact that it's not as simple as that, and that they're not just here to make a tranquilizer for people. And I think if people don't want that, that's fair. I don't know. I think what they would want would be terrible, honestly, if it was just manufacturing more happy sounds for people for a season worth.
I think that's true, but I mean, if you look at the Roy Keeley stuff, there was, you know, I think there was actual drama in that, you know, so it's not like there's no drama elsewhere in the show.
Mm-hmm. But also, I think people might be misremembering season one a bit, because, mm-hmm, yeah, there's warm and fuzzy, and yeah, you know, yeah, there's sunshine. And like, even if you watch it now, like, it's still far more a positive program than a negative program. However,
oh, totally.
Ted still goes through divorce in season one, like officially, and has a panic attack at the karaoke bar.
Jamie Tart and bullies a lot of people.
Jamie's a great
horribly.
Jamie is awful to everybody. Jamie gets bullied at the end, like, mm-hmm, you know, talking about flashbacks, like having a parent, like if you don't have a good relationship with your parents, having that at the end, like I feel like that definitely could have brought up some stuff for people. So I think part of it might just be remembering poorly, but I also think part of it is, regardless of the level of analysis you have for this program, we really like Nate, and we want Nate to be Nate the Great, and we care about him, and we want the best Nate we can get, because spending more time examining him and finding out that, like, I feel like what's happening is like he's just taking the way his dad treats him and it's coming out of him.
Oh, sure.
I think this
with just sort of more venom than like what his dad means, because it seems like some of like his dad's not necessarily like going out of his way to be mean to him or to be not nice to him in some way, but like he's just internalizing that. And as a kid who was probably bullied, like taking all of that, and the minute he gets a chance to make a different choice, he's making the choice that he's hoping is going to make him feel better, and it's not going to change anything. And it's hard to watch that, because for some people who have come out on the other side of this, or some people who have just known people who were bullied, like knowing that that sucks. And we all just want Nate to skip ahead to the end where he gets to feel good too. And it's really hard to watch him kind of up to his eyeballs in it. So yeah. I think that's part of it as well. It's uncomfortable because we care about him and we want him to be,
I think,
Nate the Great.
Yeah.
When we saw him, like towards the end of season one, he did that the roasting scene. So he kind of had that
venom.
That
venom in him. And it's just now
in that Vulture article, Nick Muhammad specifically cites that, but says if you look at Nate in season one, like we root for him because he's the underdog and he knows stuff and you know he's being kind of treated poorly and all of that, but you can absolutely look there and also see the roots of everything that's happening to him in season two. Roast Me Amigo, that scene is hilarious, but he's real mean to them, like really mean. Mm-hmm. And he obviously has a lot of anger and mean thoughts in his head that he's finally been praised to let out, right? Like it's not new with Nate. This is, it's frustrating because we want to root for him, but I think that's, you know, that's part of the storyline. I would be shocked if Ted Lasso's ultimate goal is not to have Nate have to make some hard, learn about himself and realize that he's doing wrong and try to become a better person, because that's a path that, you know, it has to be, it can't be easy. It can't be easy.
No.
Yeah. No, I agree with everything you guys said, and I apologize. I didn't mean to derail the entire Ted Sharon conversation, but yeah, it's just, it's physically tough for me to watch the whole Nate stuff. And I think that all of the explanations you guys gave, I agree with every single one of them. It's just, I just want to skip to the end when he's nice again. But what I was trying to say earlier is, you know, Roy being needy, that's a somewhat surprising retcon for me. And it's not really a retcon, but if you'll permit me, it's a somewhat weird retcon, but I can believe it. Nate being mean, I think, is more weird. But just like you said, I mean, we see elements of it in the first season. I think I can get behind Ted being as, I don't know if unstable is the word I'm looking for. He gets angry for a little while, like when he swears at Dr. Sharon, which we covered earlier. Like that's very out of character for him. In fact, he said early this season something about how people who use swear words are because, you know, they can't think of the better word to use or something like that. I forget how it was spelled out. But you know, he's very unlike him. And I think in this context, it does work for me. But it's just interesting that the three of them, Roy, Nate, and Ted in particular, jumped out at me as being very, very, very different this season, which isn't necessarily bad. I'm not trying to imply that it's bad, but it is striking, I think, how different the three of them are. Yeah. Although that being said, I will eat up anything Roy Kent.
I don't think they're different.
I don't either.
To me, I think it's like we're just seeing more layers of the onion
and
or
that's
whatever.
Fair. Mm-hmm.
I think the characters are, to me anyway, pretty consistent with their season one things. We're just getting more detail about them. And I think Nate, you know, as we said, was always like this. He's just now got the sort of outlet, victims.
Nate is more complex. I think, again, I'm going to give credit to the writers here that Nate, it's not like Nate suddenly did a heel turn and is an awful guy. Like he makes a good coaching decision. He gets his parents the table for their anniversary, right? He's trying to be more forceful, but at the same time, he's also got a swelled head and is mistreating other people. It's complicated. He's doing some really bad stuff as well as trying to progress as a human. And the moment that crystallized it for me is my favorite scene in the whole episode, which is when Beard confronts Nate.
Yeah.
And he says, "You were rude to Colin. It was personal and weird," which I thought was really good. And Nate's response is, "Did you tell Ted?" And it could be, "Oh no, I'm in trouble with the boss," but that's not what I think it is. I think it's, I I don't want to disappoint Ted. And he knows what he did was wrong. It didn't stop him from doing it. And when he apologizes for it, but he's still behaving badly, right? But mm-hmm. he knows it. He knows he's not living up to Ted Lasso. I think that's really interesting. And that Beard says you got to do better. So Beard is sort of like managing him. It's interesting that it's not Ted. I think that's really interesting that it's Beard instead. It gives Beard something to do. Also, it was mentioned earlier, he turns back and Beard is gone. And so I had a whole laugh of like, it's the internalized Beard in his head who's talking to him. But the way I'm actually choosing to interpret that is it's one of those things, you know, when your head is full of bees and you're really upset and you're processing and you kind of lose track of what's going on for a moment. So I think Nate steps out into the hallway and he's thinking about what just happened. And then he looks back and Beard's not there anymore. It's like Beard walked out like a minute ago and you just didn't even notice.
We got to the level of drawing floor plans of the office.
Go out the window.
There's a second
scenario.
There's two doors from that office, and there's one that goes through into the into Ted and Beard's office.
There you go.
So yeah, he just went in through that.
Yes, yeah, so that's what I thought as
but
well.
But it's a funny take, right? Because it's like,
He's Batman.
He is.
Yeah, he just turned back and evaporated. Right? I loved it.
If there's ever a character to do that, it would be Beard. Anyway, I like that scene because it is not only great for Beard, it lays it out there. It's Beard saying what we are all saying, which is you are messing this up. This is weird and personal and mean, and why are you doing it? And also, I think instructive that his immediate concern is, did you tell Ted? You could read that as, am I in trouble with the boss? But I really think it's more that he understands the scope of him not being. If Ted is who we aspire to be as a manager of people, he has failed it and is like, I don't want to let Ted down, but I know I've let Ted down.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there that, yes, there is the slight element of I don't want to make the boss angry, but it's absolutely I don't want to make Ted angry, irrespective of whether he's superior, inferior, or
disappoint him, right?
Like, yes, actually,
I don't
want
to disappoint him.
Better word for it.
Yeah, and I think Nate is already doing a better job of beating himself up over all of this than anybody else could. So I think that's another piece that that is sort of notable in this is that like we have to remember that it seems like he feels bad that he did it, not just that he got called out. And I think that's another piece of kind of where that conversation went. But it was, I also sort of like that Beard wasn't mad about it either. Was like, this is what, like, I saw this happen. It's not cool. And you should stop doing that. And not like, I'm mad about it or you're a bad person for doing it or any of that kind of stuff. But was just like,
do better.
I saw that this happened and you need to do better than that. And I don't think, I feel like, you know, they wouldn't have bothered if they didn't think he was capable. You know, like us, they're pulling for him too. They want the best Nate that they can get because when Nate is good, Nate is great. Like we've seen it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was
still
the other
there.
Piece of that.
I think that one of the reasons I think that I don't like the Nate storyline quite as much is because I see too much of myself in Nate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's...
When he was going through the list of tweets and it was like the one negative tweet that, you know, kind of sets him off, I was like, yeah, I don't recognize
that. Been there.
At all.
That doesn't sound familiar.
Good things whisper, bad things shout. That's how that line goes. Yeah, it is absolutely true. And then he immediately lashes out at poor Will because he's the easiest target there. And it's, he has been bullied and he is going to be a bully. And I feel like... Yeah, we'll see where this goes. I imagine something worse is going to happen, and then he's going to realize that he will realize that he needs to change his ways and get some help because he is obviously like that scene with his dad, like at the very beginning where he's like, you're getting a swelled head, boy, right? But it's like, okay, well, that's true, but also... mean, like he's a mean dad.
It does sound like the storyline is gonna continue for the remainder of the season.
It does sound like that.
I would agree with that, you know. And speaking briefly of Beard, I love Beard so much.
He's so good.
And the frustrating thing about it is the immature viewer in me, which is arguably most of me, wants to see more beard. Like, just give me more beard. I want more, 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 more. But then it obviously wouldn't be the magical, like, subtle beard that we get, that we love so much. So I understand and I appreciate the fact that they use him so sparingly and so deliberately. But yet at the same time, I want more beard so badly because I love him so much.
Well, like, he's like an axe swinging champion and, right. You know, paid, like, you know, teeth marks like somebody paid.
Yeah, right.
You've paid to be bitten. I've bitten, you know, like, like.
No, beard is the star of a very weird. I've said this on several of these podcasts. He is the star of his own very, very weird sitcom that involves him and Jane and other adventures of beard that's going on in the background and we largely don't see. And then he appears in this part of the show, in Ted's show, and for brief moments. But I love the idea that so much of beard is just bubbling under the surface and we, you know, there's a whole other show's worth of stuff about beard that we just don't get to see. We only get the little hints of it. It's so good.
Like, David Lynch has watched The Beard Show and noped out because he's like, this is too weird.
David Lynch may have directed, like, The Beard Show. In fact, it's possible. It's possible. There's a place with red curtains and people dance and it's very complicated.
There's a lady with a log that just stands in the corner.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to where this all goes. I do sort of feel, not anxious, but I feel like we need to hurry it along a little bit. Like, I don't know. I still, like I said at the beginning, I feel like we're kind of an episode behind. And
we're
so,
going to be,
I don't know,
there's five episodes, two episodes left. Behind, but one of them's an extra filling episode.
Yeah. I think it's, I'm pretty confident that a lot of things can happen in four or five episodes to deal with this, especially since the show does feel free to jump when it needs to get to the part of the story that it really wants to tell. I'm feeling okay about it.
Yeah.
I would like the sort of like the last episode, we just get the full screen 5 years later, you know, Endgame style.
It's been this long. Here you go.
One last thing that I wanted to call out, and then we'll go around and, like, if there's anything we haven't talked about that you want to mention, we can do it. I'll throw out one scene that we haven't really gone to, which is not Ted with Sharon. It's Ted at the pub. And Trent Crim from The Independent is there. And this is an interesting scene because it is probably setting up something in a future episode. It's very short. He says, well, you know, we didn't really know what happened. And Ted says the lie, which is, I had food poisoning. And Trent Crim goes away. And I thought this is the moment of the show also pointing out the stigma involved with mental health. This is Ted not being able to admit and going on with the lie, because nobody wants to say the truth, which is that Ted had a panic attack and, you know, he's seeing the sports psychologist and he's not a totally invulnerable sportsman who can do anything and has no weaknesses, right? But that's what he tells the sports journalist. And I think that there's more to that, but that's what I read out of that scene anyway, is that even though Ted has this respect for Trent Crim, he's not going to admit his weakness, you know, or at least his perceived weakness. It's such a stigma around stuff like this that he's just going to go with the lie, which is it was food poisoning.
I could see an exclusive interview towards the end of the season.
Well, Trent Crim, he's trustworthy. I think you can rely on Trent Crim to tell it like
it is. A thing we mentioned earlier was this isn't a show where anything like that where anything goes wasted. So that wasn't just, hey, remember Trent Crim, The Independent?
Yeah, no.
Like there's a reason that's what we got, and there's and I was kind of thinking about it, and there was a reason that he was the one that was picked to write the profile of Ted in the first place, was because Rebecca was setting out to get a hit piece. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you would have pressed Trent Crim, The Independent, into service for that if you didn't know it was a thing he was already capable of or had, you know, done before, maybe.
Right. But what that episode proved is that Trent Crim is actually a very good journalist who tried to not come in with preconceptions and actually wrote a piece that was fair about Ted. Right. So Trent is the person who, I mean, proved to be trustworthy, proved to be that he's not going to write about something if it isn't true.
Yeah.
But, I mean, go on.
Well, I think there's going to be more to that. Like, what that is,
for sure.
I don't know. But I definitely feel like we're going to get some payoff out of that in some way or another. And but I will say it was lovely to once again see Trent Crim the Independent.
Yes. Just hanging out.
And yeah, like just down around the pub. Yep. And I did, but I also did appreciate we got a little bit of something that didn't happen at the office. Because aside from Roy and Keeley, like we don't really see anybody anywhere else.
Right.
At least in the last few episodes, we really haven't. So it was nice to see the pub and not as part of a match. So that was the mm-hmm. other part of it that I liked.
What I was thinking was they could have easily done that scene with the three pub regulars if they just wanted to have him deny stuff.
Yeah.
But having Trent Crim in is clearly setting it up.
Well, he needed an official statement. And he was out to dinner with somebody, whoever that other person was, and said, like, I'll be out in a second, and immediately whipped the notebook out of his pocket. I just thought I appreciated that moment, too. So,
oh, and the other,
always ready to be, you know, in the midst of a story.
The other scene we only touched on is the only other place we see Ted do anything other than being in therapy, really, is this. There's the scene where they're coaching. And this is the Roy yelling at Jamie. And the whole thing of like, no, I need to go over there because I need to give him space. I need to give him his space so he can do what he wants. And Roy's like, oh.
I have to trust my teammate to do what they need to do. I
will have to say I give Saskia credit for this theory that she was thinking that Jamie, at least perhaps subconsciously, if not consciously, had all the information to put it together that of what was going on with him and Keeley, because he's in the room for at least some of that discussion.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I don't think that he's self-aware enough to actually have done that.
Exactly. Right.
But I like the fact that he was at least there and he knew at least some of the pieces of that.
I love Saskia, but I can't get on this train with her.
Yeah, I think
I think she got off the train herself eventually, but Jamie, we were just having a lot.
Jamie's maybe subconsciously involved in that, but certainly not more than that.
Yeah, he didn't. I absolutely do not believe he set out to do that. But also, I think I don't think we were recording yet when we talked about like the number of ways that Roy can drop an F-bomb and have all of them mean different things. And I feel like the salt in this particular wound was that the advice that he needed came from Jamie fucking Tart.
And the advice was correct as well.
And that it was that it was exactly the part that he needed. And that was, I think that was the salt in the wound. And like, Casey, you were talking about retconning Roy earlier. I think this might just be the first time he's had a decent relationship.
That's
and
fair. Yeah, yeah.
Just might have gone, oh, well, this is how you're supposed to do it, and now that we work together, like we just spend all our time together, and he was fine with that. And I think he will, my hope anyway, is that he will accidentally discover that having time apart is also really great for your relationship, because then when you are together, you have stuff to talk about. So
I think
I think that was part of it. So like, I don't feel like he was retconned. I think he's just figuring things out, because I don't think he's ever done this before. Because remember, we heard jokes about like, didn't your last girlfriend steal your watch and sell it, you know, and stuff. So I think... I think there's this, I'm hoping anyway, that there's a certain amount of this that is just Roy sort of blundering in and not really realizing that, everybody needs to have like their own personal time and stuff. So,
I think you're right. And the range that Brett Goldstein can use for that one 4-letter word is just so magnificent. And I am so jealous of it. It is very, very good. I also loved, and I think we touched on it earlier, that Jamie was, you know, coming to him hat in hand, like Puss in Boots, like respectfully, coach, you know, and he's trying so hard not to be a complete and utter jerk. And I do like to see that growth, because I think, as I think it was Jason that said this earlier, you know, we've seen where we are to assume that a lot of time has passed and he's really honestly trying to improve and be better. And I like seeing him try to be better, especially because it's so obvious that this is not coming natural to him. And he's really having to try in order to not be a flaming jerk.
It was a struggle in that moment, which I feel like I appreciated. Like, he was trying, because part of him wants to be like, F you, Roy. And part of him is like, but you're my coach and coaches are always telling me stuff to be better. And I really appreciated his sort of internal debate on that. So I did like that.
Just to throw in some sports nerdery, which I know I do whenever I'm on these, because you don't have to like sports or know anything about sports in order to appreciate Ted Lasso. But it's made by people who do get sports, and they know that they're not making it for an audience of sports fans. But there are things that go in, and one of the things that I think is fascinating that is a dynamic in Roy as coach is the recent former player having to adapt to being a coach. And yeah, Roy was kind of he was the leader on the field, and he was out there more for his brain than his body at the end of his career anyway. But like this really happens in sports where people who are players have to make a transition to not being players but still being involved at the coaching level, and it's different and it's hard, and there are people that you're coaching at the beginning of your career who are your former co-workers as players. And so seeing the dynamic between Jamie and Roy, and we know there's a lot else going on there, but like I think it does a pretty good job of laying out some of those issues just in passing of Roy's role has changed, and that is something that he's trying to navigate, especially with somebody he basically doesn't like Jamie, but it's his job to coach him. So I think they do a really good job at that. And so as a sports fan who's seen that kind of dynamic before, I like that that's a part of what Roy's journey has to be.
Well, and I also liked the follow on to that where when Nate came out and apologized, like I sort of appreciated that the dynamic on the team is different because like everybody came in for the group hug.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And which also maybe set something up later when Beard is like, when Ted goes, did I miss something? And Beard's like, yeah, do I need to say something here? Nope.
You know? It also seemed like Colin had told the entire rest of the team about it. Kind of is going to come back, I think.
So let me tell you, credit to Nate, though, because the coward's way out is to very quietly apologize to Colin.
Right.
Yeah.
Alone.
And that was part of what I appreciated about, and that was part of why I was so sad at the end when he went after Will with the jersey, was because I really thought that was the team coming together and doing something nice for Nate, and that they were all so ready to accept his apology, and like, we know you're cool, and you just had a moment, and we're willing to let that slide and give you a pass, and we're really happy that you know that you did the right thing, and we want everything to be good again, and we all really like you, and we want you to be one of us, and I think maybe it's that also is kind of hard on him after the way that he was treated before he got promoted.
But the difficult interpretation is that he does it in public to deflect the opinion, you know, the attitude that he's a bad guy, and then immediately when he's in private, essentially with Will, he goes back to abusing him because he can keep his abuse secret, then he can keep doing it. That would be the other read, unfortunately. Yeah.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think what was clear to me about this episode and really about the series as a whole is that it's all about the power of accountability. And I think corollary to that is the power of an apology. And so, you know, when Ted owns up to being mean to Dr. Sharon, when Roy owns up to not really paying attention or understanding what Keeley needs, you know, here with Nate apologizing to Colin, which I agree, Jason, there's a very cynical and perhaps, you know, legitimate read there. But if you take it at face value, I think so much of this very episode, and again, the whole series is about, you know, the power of accountability and how strong and how powerful accountability can make you if you're doing it for the right reasons and not, you know, just playing a game. If you'll permit me a slight tangent, what do we think about Sam and Rebecca? Like the whole three dots. I love the three dots thing. I think I'm into the Sam and Rebecca like dancing around each other. I am enjoying it. I'm very cautious and kind of nervous about how the grand introduction will presumably be either at the end of the season or beginning of next. But I am quite amused by it. And all the guys like hovering over Sam in the locker room when he sees the three dots, I thought it was very well done. And they're disappointed when they disappear. I just loved it.
Well, they both had their equivalent teams in the room when they're looking at the phone. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that bothers me with it is just the complete power mismatch between the two people. Because she's like literally, you know, the boss's boss's boss. She's the owner of the club. Yeah. I don't see it going well. I also wonder if like the stuff if the stuff with like the, you know, accusing the Nigerian government of fraud and all that stuff is going to come back, or if that's completely gone. Because if she ends up dating basically somebody who is going to be a political problem at some point, I don't see that being the nice romantic bow on it, kind of, that we're going to get at the end of the season or whatever. I think that's something that could go quite wrong.
Well, and that was part of what I was wondering, was I don't feel like they're going to get together, but I do feel like obviously their relationship is going to change once they find out who they are and that they both think each other are pretty interesting and all of that. But the part I was wondering was what sort of fallout there's going to be from this. And because if they don't get together, then what? Right. So, you know, what's it going to mean for, like, does it just mean that Sam's going to have a more direct line to management's ear when stuff is going on because the two of them have this friendship, you know, or whatever. And, I mean, mostly I just wanted to go watch Ratatouille when this was over. But like, also I just sort of wondered, like, if they decide like, oh, this is obviously a thing that we're not going to do, like, how is that going to ripple out through the rest of the series? Because it's happening for a reason. And so, like, what's the end point on that?
There's a lot of these things where, like, pieces are being put in place and we're trying to work out what the end game is. But I think we don't have enough pieces yet to sort of, like, see where we're going.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what the show's worldview is about. Like, oh yeah, they totally are going to get together, or whether it's like, well, no, this is just such an imbalance, but perhaps they learn something or they form an emotional connection that is healthy for both of them and sends them both to better places. I don't know what they're planning. So not enough information. Lots of places they could go with it. Anything more before we wrap it up?
I wanted to just do a minor tangent. In the scene where Nate is scrolling through all his Twitter messages, I thought, because they've got a fake Twitter app, I was like, well, of course they'll have, like, created accounts for this, or they will have,
James,
you know.
Of course not.
And as we discovered 2 weeks ago, no, they had not. There was, like, two old suspended but real accounts, one real account from 2015 that had never tweeted, several unregistered accounts, which, of course, I now have registered one of them. And it was just like, oh, dear, they don't seem to have learned. Maybe I'm the only person in the world that's like, oh, look, Twitter, let's type in these Twitter accounts and see if they're
real.
Oh,
but you're not.
No, I did it just before we recorded.
Because imagine my surprise when I discovered one of them was real and basically had two tweets, and one of them was, Nate, you need to get off Twitter.
and the other was a link to VaraniSports.co.uk.
Uh huh.
Yes.
Yes. I love that very much. I appreciate it greatly.
I just feel for
being that guy.
For season three, I'm not saying that they need to hire me, but if they gave me screeners ahead of time, I could give them
clean
the information.
It up. The screeners might not have the final VFX, though. You need the final VFX.
Well, that's it. I mean, it clearly wasn't like a live app. Because
the scrolling was so janky.
The scrolling was wrong, and the position of the clock and the
layout was awful.
The signal was just further down than it should be. I know it's like the phones they had in the previous episode that didn't have a notch on them. It's like
yes.
There was like, we spotted two continuity errors. Like Keely, when she gets up out of the smoking room, walks out and leaves all her stuff behind, like all her notebook and pens and everything.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
And it's like, yes, they need us brought on board. the team, clearly.
Yes, clearly.
Clearly.
All right. Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
It's your last chance.
Something small that I noticed, which I thought was very cute, was I believe it was in the smoking room that Keely said, you know that I think Roy is the cat's pajamas. And then later on at the end of the episode, Roy says to Keely, you know, I think you're the cat's pajamas, or something like that. And I just thought it was cute and adorable that the two of them use the same turn of phrase. I also kind of was, it was interesting to me, and I think probably because I happened to play I Feel Free earlier yesterday before I watched watched the episode, but they went out to Cream's I Feel Free right after Nate, you know, unloads on Will. And I'm curious if what the meaning of that was. Like, you know, is Nate embracing the devil on his shoulder and feeling free about it or something? I don't know. But just two small things that gave me kind of a little giggle, made me think a bit.
Yeah. I really appreciated Roy saying, like, I got this. The lady at the shop said that this thing is for if your feet are gross. And she's like, you think my feet are gross? And he's like, yeah, I do, because they're gross. And like, but like, didn't care. Was like, yeah, they are. It doesn't matter, but they are. You know, like, wasn't judgy about it at all. And it's one of the things that I appreciate in this show. Like, you know, we were talking about the power of accountability. I think also, like, the power of forgiveness is, like, the kind of the flip side of that, and I appreciate. And I think that's part of why people think accountability is hard, because if you hold yourself accountable to whoever it is, right, like, that person has the option to continue to be unhappy with whatever it is, you know, or they have the chance to forgive you, and it's not your call. And I think that's part of why sometimes it's hard for anyone to do that. And I think that's part of what we see in this, you know, like, I still regularly think about Ted saying, I forgive you, and Rebecca going, why? And just being baffled by it. And I appreciate, and so I think about that a lot. And one of the things I liked about this episode was that lack of judge of, like, you know, because he even says, like, who am I to judge? You know, like, you're regular. I know that's not what he said, but like, you're regularly pulling Ewoks out of the drain. Like, I get it. So it's but like, overall, I did really appreciate this episode in its own way in order to get advance everything. I felt like it was well paced, and we got a really good amount of plot advancement in that amount of time. So I did appreciate it, and it didn't feel overwhelming. So, but yes, I hope we get a weirdy beardy moment like that, like, in every episode from now on, because he doesn't have to disappear magically. Or seemingly magically.
We're going to find out at the end of the show that he was never there. It's like, have you done the thing? Like, did he touch a door at any point? Right. Did he open a door?
He's Donnie from the Big Lebowski.
I see beard people.
I just...
All right, we got to wrap it up. We've been talking for like two times as long as the episode ran. But another group that I swear isn't me, we'll be back next week to talk about episode 8, which is Man United, I think, right? Like, ooh, it's real stuff. But until then, let me thank my panelists. Kelly Gamont, thank you.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Casey Liss, thank you.
Thank you. You know, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off.
And James Thompson, thank you.
I'm here to cover a bloodstain.
Here at the old Holiday Inn. All right.
I apologize for the fruity language.
It's Man City next week in the FA Cup semifinal. Somebody will be here who isn't me to talk about it with a bunch of other wonderful people. We will see you then. Until then, football is life.